facts.
Something I know something about. It's always nice.
It is.
House Committee on Revenue for February 29, 2016 will come to order. Colleagues, we have one bill to consider today. What my plan at this moment is to take the public testimony, public hearing on Senate Bill 1507, and then recess for further developments perhaps later in the day. So with that, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1507 and get an explanation from Chris Allenheck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just lost my Wi-Fi connection, so I'm trying to get back so I don't have to do it by memory. The bill makes several changes to different tax credits. There are three technical corrections. The first pertains to the Rural Medical Providers Tax Credit. It removes references to highway miles, so it'll be as the crow fly miles, I think, or the way that it has always been done. The word highway got inadvertently inserted to the tax credit in 2015. This just removes that language. The second item is that it clarifies the policy of applying the personal kicker amounts to outstanding taxpayer debt or liability. This is the issue that the Department of Revenue came forward during legislative days and briefed you on. This just codifies that action. The third item is that it clarifies that the annual residential energy tax credit, the RETC, may not exceed $1,500 for any one device. During some of the changes that were made last session, some of the references got kind of misplaced, so there was a potential for that tax credit to hit $6,000 a year. And the fourth item that the bill does is it creates an annual taxpayer cap of $500,000 for the individual development account contributions tax credit. Doesn't change any other policies, just limits the maximum credit any one taxpayer can claim. Then that was the introduced version of the bill. The amendments that were added on the Senate side, it increases the annual cap on the film and video tax credit to $12 million this year and then $14 million in 2017. It also makes allocation changes beginning in 2017, largely to more local and rural projects. Under current law, that annual tax credit cap is $10 million. So it's a $2 million increase now and then an additional $2 million increase next year. And then lastly, it extends the biomass manure tax credit to January 1, 2022. Under current law, it's scheduled to sunset on January 1, 2018. So it's a four-year extension. And it lowers the tax credit rate from $5 per wet ton to $3.50 per wet ton beginning in 2016. You have a fiscal impact statement that is minimal and a revenue impact statement that contains a $200,000 revenue loss in 2015-17, and then in the subsequent two biennia, the revenue loss goes to $10 million and $18 million. The changes in 2015-17, the changes to the biomass tax credit raise revenue, and that largely offsets the tax credit cost of increasing the film and video tax credit. And then most of the extension in the subsequent biennia is the increase in the film and video tax credit and the extension of the biomass tax credit.
Okay, very good. Representative Gumberg is here. Let's hear from him. Welcome, Representative.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I am David Gumberg from House District 10 on the beautiful Central Oregon coast. And I'll say by way of introduction, I'm a real fan of the film and video tax credit. I think we need to do more filming on the Oregon coast. I'm particularly proud of a short scene I did with Charlize Theron in a film that was done in Depot Bay, except that she continued to refer to me in that scene as the senator, and I'm not sure exactly where that came from. But actually, I came to talk to you today about the biomass tax credit. As you know, I represent half of Tillamook County, and I'm fond of saying that Representative Boone has the creamery, but I've got all the cows, which is why I have a particular interest in the biomass tax credit, which has successfully incentivized Oregon's manure digester industry, which now processes manure from over one-third of Oregon's dairy herd, making renewable energy for over 7,000 homes. The bill extends the credit credit to give stability to allow continued adoption of this technology by Oregon dairy farmers. At the same time, the bill drops the manure biomass tax credit rate per ton by 30%, creating savings of over $1 million from current policy. There are several benefits to these digesters. They remove methane and odor from the air and provide reliable, renewable energy, which are all good things for my district and for the state. I'm here to urge passage of Senate Bill 1507 to the floor. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do you want to talk about the measure at all and what the value of it is in your district?
I just wanted to touch on my general support. I know that you've got other people signed up today, so in respect for your time, Mr. Chairman, and for other appointments that I need to get to, I'm going to let them address more specific questions for you.
All right.
Except again to say I think it's a good thing. I want to see it move forward.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions for the representative? Don't see any. Nobody's looking up. All right.
I was going to ask him about his movie, but I can't find it on Google, so.
Oh, you better give us the answer to that one.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. Representative knows. Google the burning plane with Charlize Theron.
Okay, all right, I'm going to do it right now.
P-L-A-N-E? Right.
Plane. Like the rain in Spain is mainly on.
P-L-A-I-N.
Okay, I'm doing it right now.
All right. Thank you. All right. Let's hear next from, I don't have any panels, so I'm kind of making up as I go. Let's hear next from Doug Barber, Tim Williams, and Kevin Mass. You're all, I think, going to talk about different things, so we'll deal with them separately. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association in support of Section 1 of the bill, which deals with the Rural Health Tax Credit. You'll remember that last session you made two changes in the tax credit. One of them was to tier the benefit, so those with from 10 to 20 miles receive $3,000, 20 to 50 miles it's $4,000, and 50 and beyond it is $5,000. The other change that was made was how that distance was calculated. It had always been as the crow flies from the time the tax credit was started. The change that was made was to insert the words highway miles. When the Office of Rural Health calculated what that change would do, it actually would add 718 providers to the tax credit, primarily along I-205 in Portland, places that most of us would not consider rural. These were communities like Gladstone, Oregon City, Wilsonville. All would be 718 of them would now be in the tax credit at a cost of $2.1 million. We knew that that was not what the legislature intended. So we brought that issue to legislative revenue, and hence Section 1 of this bill, which simply pulls out those three words, the highway miles designation. It goes back to as the crow flies, and it saves that $2.1 million. Happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Let's go along.
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, for letting me speak with you. My name is Tim Williams. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Film, the State Film and Video Office. I'll try to make this brief, as I know there's many people who would like to testify, but I want to give some background information on the Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF, which is addressed in SB 1507A. Since the introduction of OPIF in 2005, Oregon Film has tracked the economic activity directly attributed to the incentive programs, rising from just below $10 million per year to now almost $170 million per year, while the number of jobs that has climbed from 500 just in 2005 to more than 3,000 last fiscal year. More than 100 individual projects and countless local companies and producers have been directly assisted with their work here in Oregon over the last decade, resulting in more than $1 billion in tracked economic activity over the last decade. Currently this fiscal year, the OPIF program is working with more than 30 different projects, which will all benefit in some way from the incentive programs. We work very hard to ensure that the limited OPIF funds are spread throughout our growing industry and throughout the state, from the smallest of narrative documentaries in Ashland to the largest of animated features in network TV series in Hillsborough and Clackamas. Our effort is always to maximize the scope of the creators, producers, companies, and projects which can be helped through the current $10 million allocation of the OPIF program. And because of the growing permanent talent base here in Oregon, 20 of the 23 projects and companies aided by the state's incentive programs last fiscal year were either directly produced by Oregon companies or individual Oregon producers, utilizing a large local crew and hundreds of local vendors. As a point of reference, season two of The Librarians, in just the third quarter of 2015, engaged and paid almost 300 local vendors for work done in a series in only a three-month period. Even the small-budget independent feature Black Road, produced and shot in Medford and Brookings, engaged more than 70 local vendors. The story that is unfolding is one of a balanced system that imports work into the state as much as it creates work from established companies and individuals already here in the state. The incentive programs are instrumental in making media work more competitive here in Oregon in a national landscape that currently has more than 30 states offering film and media incentive programs. However, because our program is capped on an annual basis, we continue to have many missed opportunities. Currently, in order to keep even the multi-year TV series that we've worked very hard to attract, we will come up short in the coming fiscal year. In order to retain these productions, we are borrowing from the future, and this process cannot continue, and we will fail to meet the needs of our long-standing television series, surely leading to at least one of those productions moving to a new production base like Vancouver, BC, or Atlanta, Georgia, states and provinces with more lucrative incentive programs. In fact, in the last week alone, my office has had substantive conversations with another network TV program, two feature films, and two animated series, all looking to use Oregon as their production base. SB 1507A will raise the annual cap of the OPIF program from $10 million per year to $12 million this year, and then $14 million in 2017. In addition, it would increase the amount allocated for indigenous production, or IOPIF, from 5% over the overall fund to 7.5% of the overall fund, effectively doubling the funds available for smaller projects by local companies. It also allows locally produced, larger budgeted interactive and post-production projects to qualify for the larger OPIF program, keeping up with their continued steady growth here in the state. It also caps the amount that any single project can take from the fund within any given fiscal year at 50% of the overall allocation. Lastly, I'd also like to speak briefly about the Rural Initiative. This program, or ROPIF, is a much-needed addition to our program, which would not only financially encourage existing Portland-based productions like Portlandia, Grimm, and The Librarians to shoot at least a few days of their productions outside of the Portland production zone. It also has a second part to the proposed amendment, which would further incentivize production basing themselves outside of Portland for the majority of their shoot. After all, almost all of the iconic movies that have shot in this state have been based outside of Portland, from The General in Cottage Grove to Paint Your Wagon in Baker City, The Goonies in Astoria, Animal House in Eugene, Stand By Me in Brownsville, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest here in Salem, and more recently, Wild in Bend, Crater Lake, and Ashland. All of this production continues to attract visitors and producers to Oregon alike. The incentives question is what starts the conversation with all producers and companies who call, both from outside the state and from here within Oregon. And in those cases where we are able to bring something in the way of incentives, we generally are able to close the deal and make amazing work produced here with the amazing talent which already lives here year in and year out. So through OPIF, we have seen a consistent growth in the creation of well-paying jobs with benefits and the engagement of countless local vendors, a diversity of creative economic projects being produced here in the state, and the introduction of the Rural Amendment will have a specific tool to encourage more creative work in all parts of the state. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you. We've got two diverse topics and a third one coming up. Are there questions for Mr. Williams now on the film and video portion of this thing? Let me ask one then. You may have mentioned it, but if you did, I missed it. What the whether or not we have any studies that indicate to us what our actual second and third order tax revenues are produced by this activity.
Chairman Barnhart, the last economic development report we had was in 2011, and I'm in the midst of commissioning one now,
okay.
And have that will be done during this calendar year and will be available at the beginning of the next session.
Great. And that will help us understand how all this expansion in jobs actually either leads to or doesn't lead to an increase in the state's revenue as a result of that.
Yes, Chairman Barnhart.
Among other things.
Yes, Chairman Barnhart. That absolutely is what we will be looking at, and I've been talking to several different economic development reporting companies to help us with that.
Great.
Including the University of Oregon as well.
All right. Thank you. Let's hear about Tillamook.
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart. Members of the committee, my name is Kevin Moss with Farm Power. We own and operate two manure digesters in Tillamook County, working with six family farms and about 5,000 cows out there. I'm here today in support of 1507 as it came to you from the Senate, and I have a couple of slides for you. The manure biomass tax credit has created a boom in manure being turned into energy in the state of Oregon. It's gone from just a few thousand cows to about a third of the manure the dairy manure in Oregon currently being turned into energy. You can see the biomass tax credit was introduced a number of years ago. After a delay of a couple years, people started building digesters, as did we. We are the green and the dark blue on there. We are here in part because we would like to build more. Manure digesters are energy-producing machines that also have environmental benefits. If I jump back to this slide, besides just showing the number of cows, this also shows the equivalent impact on greenhouse gases in number of cars. So the number of cows, about 40,000. The methane being captured from all those cows, rather than letting it just rise from the manure lagoons, is similar to taking about 40,000 cows off the road. But also manure digesters, we sell energy, we pay skilled operators. We've got a couple of guys in Tillamook County making on average about $75,000 a year out there maintaining these somewhat complicated, but large engines that turn methane into energy. You know, we like doing that. We pay a lot of property taxes out there. We sell fiber, which is separated from the manure, to the farmers. Overall, the biomass tax credit allows us to create a lot of benefits in rural areas that greatly exceed the cost of the tax credit. Other digesters in Tillamook County, in the Willamette Valley, in eastern Oregon do the same. We are here to cut the tax credit as well as ask for the extension in the bill. We're doing that because if people want to build more manure digesters, they need to know that the tax credit's going to be there for a few years. It takes 1.5-2 years to prepare, permit, design a digester, and then build it. If you pass 1507, I can say with confidence that we are going to be out working with dairy farmers in Tillamook, trying to add to that lighter green line there, trying to develop new projects, expand the industry, but yet not cost anymore, because we've come up with this compromise rate that encourages new development of manure digesters, but also supports a wide variety of projects that are already there. You know, much smaller projects that have different cost structures, our projects. It's a good rate that saves the state money, but yet expands the industry. Why do we need the biomass tax credit in the first place? Well, right now, to build a manure digester and just sell electricity, the payback is too long to even pay back the project during the time of a power purchase contract. So you can get 15-year contracts in Oregon. A digester without a biomass tax credit would take over 20 years to pay it back. So we encourage you to pass 1507A in its current form, extend the tax credit, provide an incentive for new digesters, support the ones you already have, including the one at the Port of Tillamook Bay, run by the port to serve 6 or 8 different family farms in Tillamook, support them, support new projects, save a little money now, and keep this industry going, providing renewable energy, methane reductions, and local economic benefits. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah, Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've, in the past several years, brought a bill called the Climate Metrics Bill, which is designed to kind of try to figure out how much we're actually paying per ton of CO2 avoided. And in this case, it would take some considerable work to figure out, A, how many tons of methane are being avoided by virtue of that which you are designing, building, and then implementing. And then you would have to back out a number of things that are offset by other goods that are generated by this approach, other values. But at the end of the day, there'd still be some component of what we're paying for that would be allocated to the reduction of CO2 or methane. Have you created those numbers for us? Let me explain why I ask. We are spending an awful lot of the state's money and ratepayer money in reducing CO2, but we seem to have wide variation in people's estimates of how much it's costing per ton for reduction purposes. The reason it's so important is that we have limited resources and we need to prioritize their investment so that we put the money where it can do the most good. And I would suggest that we've not done a good job of that at all to this point in this state. But you can help us get started by explaining to us how many of our dollars are going to the part of what you're doing that's going to reduce methane and how much it's costing the state.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, to quickly answer that question, and we can get you much more detailed numbers later, even tomorrow, if you'd like, and it's obviously a priority for you, so we can do that. But in rough terms, the carbon offset portion of the business is about 10% of, say, our revenues or of our activities. So most of it is producing electricity. Some of it is that fiber. Some of it is processing, you know, manure, food waste at different prices. So about 10%. So if you look at a $4 million program, let's just assume that about $400,000 of state support is going towards the part of the business that reduces carbon. On average, a cow's reduction is about 5 tons. So rough numbers here, it's about 200,000 tons of carbon offsets or carbon reduction being created a year by the current industry. $400,000 to that portion of the business, let's say about $2 a ton. That's, you know, well below market. That's definitely not making the difference between people who would or wouldn't do that. We want to do digesters for a wide range of benefits, and the carbon offsets is, like I said, about a 10% portion of that business.
If I may follow.
Please, yeah.
And thank you for that number. In our most recent discussion on another bill, carbon coal to clean, I think one of the numbers we've heard is $400 a ton. So obviously we should be taking that money and putting it all into manure digester. if it's only $2 a ton at your dairies. But I've noticed that there's an awful lot of variation in people's estimates on these things, and they get awfully complicated. But I would very much like to see those numbers from you so that we can use them in trying to decide how best to invest the state's money when it comes to CO2 reduction. So look forward to seeing the numbers.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And I appreciate Representative Benz's approach, because I think he's absolutely correct with the fact that the state has very limited dollars that it can invest in climate change issues, and figuring out which gets us the biggest bang for the buck is very important. And then, of course, the things he did not mention are the effects that we may have on the economy by doing a subsidy. You know, subsidies often lead to more of the same, and so those are gets pretty complicated pretty fast. But I really appreciate that approach. Other questions? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on my colleague's line of questioning, just to try to put it into perspective, I guess, from the standpoint of the power that's produced through the electricity, and how does that compare with, let's say, residential solar, industrial-based solar, utility scale? Do you have a – what kind of – the contracts that you're entering into with your utilities for purchase agreements, can you just tell us briefly kind of how much per kilowatt hour, you know, you and your comrade, your colleagues are being reimbursed for?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, we on average are being paid about 8 cents a kilowatt hour for our electricity. That is less than what most consumers pay for it. That's more than some sources of power, hydro obviously being one of the cheapest, but it's less than other sources. We're able to make it work at those prices because we have a variety of revenue streams. I would say on average, electricity revenue is maybe about two-thirds of our business, then of course that carbon component and then the fiber and some other stuff. So we can make it work at market rates. Contracts now often start much lower than that, say at 4 or 5 cents, and then move up closer to 10. We haven't signed any of those contracts, but if the tax credit's extended, I think we'd like to.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Whitson.
I have a question for the film industry representative. Please. Yeah. On page 8, for subsection 8, travel and living expenses rebate of $200 per employee per day for any day that a film is shot entirely outside of the Portland metropolitan zone. So is that the allowable IRS living expense that, you know, a typical business allows to come off from taxes?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, that was calculated more about what is generally spent when a production goes outside of the 30-mile zone in terms of what they pay in hotel costs or what's called a per diem cost in order to help that offset them going outside of the 30-mile zone, which has a significant expense in terms of their labor. So it's linked more to what happens when they go outside of that piece is for the productions that are based in Portland that are moving outside of the 30-mile zone.
Okay. May I follow up?
Please, yes.
Are you aware what the legislators get per day for their per diem?
Chairman Barnhart, Representative Whitney, no, not off the top of my head.
Well, it's significantly less than that, shall we say. And many of us live on the other side of the state, and we have to live in hotels and eat here. And so I think that's a little high, $200 a day.
Except once in a while.
Representative Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, we're not trying to link to the per diem paid to employees. We were trying to offset the cost for the productions to go outside, which would include overtime and hotel accommodations as well as food and mileage as well. So we were trying to come up with a round number that would allow them. And it's capped as well on a per project basis.
Yes, but it does say per employee per day, so you did break it into by employee, and I see the cap on there, but I mean, it's just something, it just doesn't sit quite right. If it's not the federal allowable IRS, you know, it seems like it's more than what is allowed by typically by law. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yep, let's follow up on that a little bit. I see that this section 4 or subsection 4 at the top of page 8 is an add-on. I think I have an idea what that's about, but maybe you can explain why that's added in there this time.
It was, Chairman Barnhart, it was originally an amendment to our original bill on the Senate side and was added in after the original bill was introduced, and therefore it came in as a separate section.
And can you explain what the point of it is?
That is all part of what I'm calling the rural initiative. So it is the two-part system that incentivizes projects to get outside of the Portland metro zone, which is a 30-mile production zone, as well as incentivizes projects separately that base themselves outside of Portland completely for their entire shoot or the majority of their shoot, which is 50% of their shooting schedule plus at least one day. So we were trying to address two parts of that, which is the ones that are already in Portland, how can we give them a reason to go out and shoot other parts of the state that are very visual and necessary, as well as how can we get projects to go and stay in Bend or Klamath Falls or Ashland for most of their shoot.
Right. That's what I thought you were going to say, but I think it's useful. It's all part of the attempt on the part of your office and of the legislature to move more production outside of the core into more rural areas of the state.
Yes, Chairman Barnhart. The idea is that there are so much diversity of locations in this state that getting people out, I think, to shoot that is easy in terms of showing them pictures of everything. But then when it's a bigger crew, there's a lot more expense when you're away from a what they've defined as their production zone. And many of these places define Portland as their production zone when they land. If we can get them to define their production zone as some other place, it often makes it a lot easier for them to stay there, hire locally, use local vendors. And so this tries to address both sides of that coin.
Right. Other questions generated? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony, and you successfully packed a lot of material into a short period of time. I'm going to go down the list of the others wishing to testify. Kender Kim Broski, Edith Rush, Jody Weiser, please. Oh, there she comes. Okay, I thought maybe Jody wasn't here. Please go ahead.
All right. Thank you. From movies to manure. Chair Barnhart, thank you so much for this opportunity to testify.
That is one of the milder jokes I've heard.
Right. members of the committee, my name is Kendra Kimbaraskas, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Socially Responsible Agricultural Project. I'm here today because in 2007, I was appointed by Governor Kulongowski, along with 14 other citizens representing public health organizations, sustainable ag organizations, environmental groups, state agencies, and legislators to the Dairy Air Quality Task Force. I'm here speaking to you because I oppose the inclusion of the manure digester credit extension in Senate Bill 1507. In learning about Senate Bill 1507A, I reviewed testimony from Three Mile Canyon Farms and the Dairy Farmers of Oregon in support of the bill, and I feel that I have to provide some historical context to set the record straight. I understand that several of you may not have been actually in the legislature yet, so I wanted to provide this context. The Dairy Air Quality Task Force spent over 6 months deliberating to find consensus from diverse stakeholders as the best way to address emissions from large-scale dairy confinement operations like Three Mile Canyon Farms, 55,000 dairy cows. This came after a heated legislative battle where the dairy industry and Three Mile Canyon Farms were working hard to exempt agriculture from having to comply with the state's air rules. This was at a time when Three Mile Canyon Farms was in the news quite a bit because the ammonia gas coming from the manure lagoons were contributing to acid rain in the eastern end of the Columbia River Gorge. After many months of work, I felt that we as a task force came together and were able to come up with reasonable compromise and plan on how the state agencies would work together to address the variety of concerns. Siri, surrounding emissions from mega dairies. The recommendations that we put forward were that the Environmental Quality Commission, working with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the Department of Human Services, were to develop a dairy air quality program. The program was to be both voluntary and regulatory in nature and to incentivize best management practices. We agreed that one provision of this program would be to provide tax credits for operations that took steps to mitigate their air emissions. After the completion of our report and after it was presented to the legislature in 2008, Three Mile Canyon Farms and others went to work to ensure that the program would never be implemented. This is why I find it absolutely disingenuous that both organizations have submitted testimony alleging that Senate Bill 1507A would be in accordance with the recommendations of the Dairy Air Quality Task Force report. We should not be allowing Three Mile and others to urge you to cherry-pick pieces from the report that would benefit mega dairies without adopting other elements that would address other aspects of the program, such as environmental and public health concerns with dairy emissions. While the Dash 19 amendment is certainly better than previous amendments, methane digesters only address methane gas from decomposing waste. Other gases such as hydrogen sulfide, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and ammonia are unaffected. Ironically, ammonia is the gas that was at the center of the legislative debate back in 2007 that kicked off this whole Dairy Air Quality Task Force program. And ammonia remains unaffected by methane digesters. Further, I have heard through a number of channels that there is an active recruitment campaign taking place that Three Mile and others of Oregon and the Dairy Farmers of Oregon are engaged in to attract more of these mega and out-of-state dairy operations into the state. Not only will this continue to drive smaller producers out of business, many of the producers that own those cows in Representative Gomberg's district, but it will further compromise clean air and water in our state. We should under no circumstance be extending a tax credit to mega operations without ensuring that adequate provisions are in place to protect local communities, public health, and the environment from the pollution that comes from these industrial-style farms. I'm urging you to not support Senate Bill 1507A. I think that this discussion is one that warrants a bigger conversation about implementing the Dairy Air program in its entirety as it was outlined by the hard work of our task force in 2007. I would welcome getting that old gang back together and moving forward to seeing if our recommendations can be fully implemented in the 2017 legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Chairman Barnhart and members of the House Revenue Committee, I thank you for this opportunity to share my perspective. My name is Edith Roush, and I'm a volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon. I'm here today to raise some hard questions about Senate Bill 1507, and more specifically, the amendments A16, 17, and now 20, which are very much some tweaking, but the same thing. I've been away from this legislative body for 20 years because of advice given to me by the late Senator Frank Roberts. I was a policy intern with Frank during the year this body agonized over how to implement Measure 5. It was quite a learning experience. When I decided to pursue a career in higher education, leaving K-12, Frank advised me to leave the state because he said, it will take many decades for Oregon to recover from these decisions. I returned to Oregon 3 years ago and quickly observed vivid consequences of Measure 5. In my view, Senator Roberts was prescient. Oregon has been deeply damaged by Measure 5 and many subsequent referendums after that you've grappled with in this legislature. But mostly, legislators have addressed the lost funds by attempting to supercharge the state's economic engines via tax benefits for business. Not a bad idea, but one that has really conflicted with what happened to educational funding with Measure 5. The concerns the colleagues I have at TFO and I have about A16, 17, and 20, and tax credit proposals in several other sections of 1507 is this. Cumulative tax breaks affect Oregon's revenue stream, particularly for education and social services. Back when I was working with Frank, those were the only two areas that they could find the money to actually support what Measure 5 did. It was higher education and social services. And I think my observations is the decline of that in the last 20 years after being away from the state is unbelievable. Complex tax bills are bills with tax incentives that are nearly impossible to reverse do affect long-term revenue streams. I'm asking you to turn these tax credits down with or without the $15 million a year limit. We simply can't afford another lost 3/4 of a day of school per year for every child in the state of Oregon. That's what it actually represents. As Mike Rogaway reported in Sunday's Oregonian, well-intended tax breaks can lead to very real implications for millions of dollars in tax revenue. He was referring to the tax credit given to Google that now Comcast is taking advantage of, which will cost the state millions of dollars. The very serious truth is every one of these beneficial tax credits reduces the state's resources for the fundamental engine of any economy. And that's the educational system. As I looked at the amendments on A20, it offers tax credits for such a broad swath of Oregon business endeavors that it left me actually wanting to propose a credit for Oregon educators based on the number of minds that they actually grow every day. But Frank's conscience is in my ear saying, Edie, that would just make the problem worse, so I won't propose that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart, are you considering the minimum wage proposals today or not?
Why don't you introduce yourself? And
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon.
That's a complex question. Why don't you give your testimony and then we'll let me put it this way. I don't have the authority to tell the other members of the committee what motions they can make when we get to work session.
Okay.
So that's the best answer I can give.
All right. So I want to comment on two of the other parts of the bill, and then I want to talk about the minimum wage proposal. The extension for the manure facilities, the proposal says we'll pay the same amount to Three Mile Canyon, which now gets more than half of the money each year. And they have 37 head of cattle in one place. 37,000 head of cattle in one place. Economies of scale would say that their subsidy would be different than the subsidy for somebody with 400 or 4,000 head of cattle. And this, the proposal you have before you is not paying attention to that. You've not been given any money to show that whether these operations are actually profitable. And when you read the press and the ag magazines, it talks about digesters being profitable. And yet, before digesters came along, these businesses had big piles of manure that they had to spend money dealing with. So the operation wouldn't necessarily need to be profitable for it to be something that farmers should be doing. And so I think we just simply have not done the review of this tax break that we are supposed to do in a year, and we should wait until a year from now to do it. The film and video tax credit has come to you repeatedly for the last 10 years asking for more money. They got $1 million the first time we gave them money. They're at 10 now. They're asking for a 40% increase. Who else did you give a 40% increase to? And they're adding a new program, which actually, Whitsitt, would, as I read the law, mean that they would get $240 a day for filming at Multnomah Falls, rather than at the Burnside Bridge, because they already get 20% of everything they spend, including what they spend on lodging and food. So then you would be adding a 200 to that. A better proposal would be to say the reimbursement for all your expenses in Portland is reduced from 20% to 16%. And it's 20% if you're outside, say, the middle range of a minimum wage, of the minimum wage tiering, and it's 22% if you're in the lowest end of the minimum wage tiering, and that would kind of push people where you're trying to push people, I think. But also, in looking at all the filming that's been done, there's been a lot of filming done in rural Oregon. There has not been a big drop in the filming in rural Oregon since we started doing tax credits. And in fact, there's actually been a drop in the total percentage, total number of projects every year. But that's because we're competing against states that are offering tax credits. And it used to be when we got Goonie, for instance, there were no tax credits. It was just a good place to film. But the main thing I wanted to talk about today is a different perspective on the farm experience. I've listened to the testimony on the floor, and so much of the conversation about the minimum wage is about farmers. And then we've got three amendments now that basically deal with everybody in the natural resource industry that I can think of except mining. And so I want to share a story that comes from my own family. I grew up on a farm. My dad was a farmer who sold wheat and cotton on the international market and alfalfa on the regional market. And he would identify with Oregon's farmers, because, especially those who lived near the state border, because our farm was 7 miles from Arizona. And Arizona had a strikingly different regulatory tax and subsidy program from that in California, and wages for that matter. He would understand their dismay at the proposed minimum wage increases because, like my dad, Oregon farmers are competing, most of them, on a global market, whether it's grass seed or nursery stock or Christmas trees that go to Mexico or pears that go to Japan. I mean, most farm product is international, unless it's something like alfalfa that's going to the closest dairy. But decades ago, when faced with a similar campaign to increase workers' pay and benefits, my dad suddenly began providing full family medical and a retirement plan for his employees. He did that because Cesar Chavez has started organizing in the Mid-Valley of California, several hundred miles away, and he and his neighboring farmers did not want him coming to our valley. And so they thought, how do we keep him away? Oh, we give our employees what he thinks they should have. They weren't motivated by altruism, and it wasn't because they'd had a lot of recent profitability. They felt forced to make a change that would keep Cesar Chavez away. And what was the result? None of the farmers went bankrupt. And probably my father retired farming 4,000 acres instead of 5,000 acres. He started with 40. It probably retarded the growth of his ability to purchase other people's land, but it didn't make a significant difference in my life. As for farm workers, however, at my class reunion, I was talking with a classmate who had worked his whole life in fields at rather low-level jobs. And during that time, he had worked for two of the farmers who, like my father, had started offering these better benefits. So I asked him, knowing that he would have earned barely above minimum wage, probably his whole career, how are you making it now? And he said, well, I get my Social Security, and I get a retirement fund check for $345. And I said, I know where those $345 came from. And I told him the Cesar Chavez story. It's remarkable how you feel pushed by the realities of other people's lives, and then you respond, and you actually make it. Major shifts in economic fairness between the have-mores and the have-less have always been initially met with dismay and consternation. If you think of the factories that employed children making clothes in the East or any of the other huge shifts where we've changed the laws, the owners particularly have not liked it. And yet, those businesses end up succeeding. We urge you to reject that dash, 16, 17, and 20 now, I believe. The benefits to the farmers' workers will monumentally outweigh the increase of the business's expenditures by an increase in Oregon's minimum wage. I wish today's farmers could talk with my father.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? You specifically omitted any discussion of the Dash 19 amendments.
I don't remember that one at the moment.
That's the one that limits the credit for biodigesters to $5 million.
Well, so $5 million. I did do an analysis of the current expenditures, and we're spending, I think it was $3.6 million right now. So that would probably help cover the new digester that was just announced today is getting a USDA loan guarantee of $11 million for a $25 million plant at the Boardman facility, I think in the Enterprise Zone at Boardman, because they're going to be processing onion peels, potato peels, and manure there. I don't know whether onion and potato peels would meet our requirements for energy producing biomass or not. I don't think we've ever considered that as a possibility. And I have spoken with people and learned that almost everybody that works at that Enterprise Zone actually lives in the Tri-Cities, which maybe is good for Oregon. We're subsidizing jobs for people from another state, but they have to pay income taxes to us, and Washington State has to educate their kids. But it is an odd situation. So the $5 million is not going to compact it too much.
Thank you. And I thought I heard you say something about the Dash 19, and maybe I missed that. Did you?
I did, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I urged you to. I oppose the bill with the Dash 19 in it. I think it's better. The $3.50 is better than $5, but I think that we should not be moving forward with a discussion about incentivizing new industrial farms without a discussion about the problems that come with emissions from large-scale dairy operations. Essentially, what happens is manure digesters become the tail that wags the dog. If you build it, you have to feed it. So that means there's more large-scale dairy operations coming in, and we have to talk about the impacts of those operations before giving tax incentives for these operations to be built.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I have one more person signed up, Marcia Kelly. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? Yes, please, come forward. Len, you want to be heard? No?
Testimony's in the record from Marty Myers.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Marcia Kelly with the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I, too, oppose the change in the biomass date. I think it would be more appropriate to spend joint tax committee time looking at what the real implications of these issues are. And just doing a real brief look, there are some of the digesters have gotten major federal grants instead of tax credits. At least it's a grant instead of a tax credit for part of their digesters. And I think that the long session would give everyone a chance to do a more adequate look at this proposal. Again, have concerns with the film and video. They left out sometimes a great notion, which I believe was filmed over in the Oregon coast when they were listing all of the pictures that had been done in Oregon. And if I remember rightly, and I'm old enough, I think I do, a lot of the films were made prior to the time we had tax credits. The rural definition of 30 miles from the Burnside Bridge, to me, seems a little bit less than rural if you take a look at what's in the Portland metropolitan area. So I think that the technical fixes in 1507 where the bill started out would be a nice thing to do and a good thing to do, but I think the things that have been added on are less than a technical fix and should go through the Joint Tax Credit Committee in the long session 2017.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Maluski with Friends of Family Farmers. We're here today to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 1507A. Specifically, we're opposed to the provisions that extend the significant subsidies for manure digesters on large-scale industrial dairy operations in Oregon. While the bill does reduce this subsidy from $5 per wet ton of manure to $3.50 per wet ton, it also extends the sunset for a significant amount of time, 4 to 5 years. Given the existing flaws in this tax credit and the fact that it primarily benefits one company, as you've seen on the charts, we believe a deeper review of the policy implications of extending this tax credit are needed and should not be done in the haste of the 2016 session when no policy committee has reviewed the pros, cons, or alternatives available. While subsidized manure digesters can hypothetically allow smaller-scale dairies to provide community-level energy while reducing water pollution, in reality, the bulk of the taxpayer money distributed during the life of this credit so far has gone to a single operation, Three Mile Canyon Farms, which is owned by an out-of-state company and is the state's largest factory-scale dairy operation with over 50,000 cows in confinement. Nothing in Senate Bill 1507A changes the current imbalance in how this credit is distributed, and if no additional amendments are made, the tax credit will continue to predominantly flow to one operation, potentially even after its initial investment has been paid for by taxpayers. Under this tax credit, millions of dollars in taxpayer funds each biennium are going to Three Mile Canyon Farms. When this and other companies built their digesters after the credit was first created in 2007, they were fully aware of the sunset in 2017, and so its expiration should not be, and it should not impact any operations business plans. However, as extended in this bill, the tax credit will not only continue to be primarily used to subsidize a single operation, whose growth has, in fact, coincided with the loss of small-scale dairy farms in this state. We're concerned it will lead to taxpayer subsidies for new incoming factory-scale dairy operations that agree to build manure digesters. tax credits of this generous scale and open-endedness can really be the tail wagging the dog, as has been said, for confinement livestock operations that may not otherwise be economically viable. I guess it's important to note here as well that manure digesters really only make sense in operations where our animals are confined in buildings. Those farms that graze animals on pasture, the old-fashioned way, if you will, for most or all of the year, do not have the same manure management problems that manure digesters are partly intended to solve. In short, this tax credit benefits and serves to promote a certain type of agriculture in Oregon and disadvantages those producers who raise animals on pasture. We talk a lot about advantaging some types of agriculture over another. That's what this tax credit, in fact, does. It's our belief that taxpayer subsidies should not be used to fund large-scale confined or concentrated animal feeding operations in Oregon, whether from manure digesters or otherwise. These operations are typically very well capitalized, and they are often in competition with smaller-scale operations. Already operating on small margins, many small dairies cannot compete with the larger farms that are coming in, especially those that are unable to take advantage of tax credits or other subsidies. Indeed, according to a 2013 report from the Oregon Employment Department, in the years following the establishment of Three Mile Canyon Farms, Mega Dairy and Boardman, nearly half of Oregon's dairy farms went out of business, on average 9 dairy farms per month between 2002 and 2007. If a policy goal of this tax credit is to support smaller farms, it is not working to serve that goal. And we would suggest at a minimum clarifying amendments to this bill that it only be made available to smaller or mid-sized farms. Further, we're concerned, as has been noted earlier, that the state has not followed through with the recommendation of 2008's Task Force on Dairy Air Quality, which is intended to fund new air quality monitoring, encourage best practices, and in 2015, should it have been funded, begin enforcement of air quality violations from larger dairies. And like Three Mile Canyon Farms, we were a member of that task force, which was created in 2007. Unfortunately, the consensus recommendations have never been fully followed through on. To date, no money has been dedicated to add air quality monitoring at large dairies or to encourage best practices or to rein in air pollution problems from the largest operations. Instead, huge sums of money have flowed to tax credits for a small handful of farms that now have manure digesters, with, again, most of that money going to one operation, and which is still likely the state's largest source of agricultural air pollution, and it's not being monitored at all. I've directed you in my testimony to the full task force report so that you can look at the full slate of policy recommendations. And we believe funding this task force's consensus recommendation should take priority over continued funding of this ineffective and costly manure digester tax credit. So we would strongly recommend that the Revenue Committee amend this bill to either remove the extension of the digester tax credit or, at a minimum, extend it for a very short period of time at the reduced rate so that the larger policy implications and alternatives that better support Oregon's small and mid-sized farms can be discussed during the 2017 session. With regard to the -19 amendment, we do think it's a step in the right direction because it both restricts the credit to only existing operations as opposed to new, and it caps it at $5 million. However, we would argue that the $5 million cap is still too high, and we would recommend something significantly lower if you are to adopt some sort of amendment along those lines. So thank you for your consideration of our comments today. Be happy to take any questions or talk with any of you after the fact. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes.
I just have a comment.
Comment.
You cannot graze dairy animals outside year-round in about three-quarters of this state. So that's not an option. We have to have CAFOs if we're going to have this industry. This is one of the largest industries for agricultural in the state of Oregon. It brings in a lot of money, and it is just not a possibility due to the cold, the snow, and the rain. It would be inhumane to the animals. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Colleagues, as I indicated earlier, we're not ready to work this bill as yet. And so if you have comments on, in the line of the public hearing, it would be useful to make them now. If not, we'll recess in hopes of meeting again later in the day. Okay. With that, the committee, I'm not certain what time it is. The House meets at 2:30, and there may be some other work we need to do before we're ready, so that I can't give a specific time for reconvening. Stay close and be prepared. That committee is in recess. House Committee on Revenue will come back to order. Colleagues, when we recessed, I had neglected to close the public hearing, so we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on the bill we're dealing with today, House Bill, or Senate Bill 1507A. Representative Bentz?
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 15, House Bill or Senate Bill?
Senate Bill.
Senate Bill 1507A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bentz moves Senate Bill 1507A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be supporting the bill. I do want to point out for the record that some of these tax credits in the past have created great difficulty as time has passed after we've enacted them, and I would anticipate that we will be asked by perhaps the Department of Energy or others to look at this bill and the contents of it in the years next year, maybe 2 years after. So those who are going to enjoy these tax credits must understand that they will be asked to perhaps come back in and report on how things are going. And I think it's extraordinarily important that be understood because I don't want to be surprised again, as has been the case in the other tax credit situations. So I want to compliment the Department of Energy for bringing the issue before us 2 years ago or a year ago now, and I anticipate that we'll be looking at these credits again over the next couple of years.
Representative Nellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question about the digester tax credit. I'm sorry if I haven't been following this as closely as I should. It's capped at $5 million, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
No.
It's not capped
not
at all?
Not in the A version.
No.
There's no program.
It is my anticipation, Representative Nellis, that if I am back next time, I will reintroduce the amendment that I proposed on this bill, either as a standalone bill or as part of the tax credit discussion that takes place. The testimony that we heard today and that we've seen before suggests that the cap would not be reached in a period of time that would cause a problem for us to act on it in 17.
Okay, so the may I follow?
Please,
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Sorry. So the impact that I'm seeing to the general fund of $17.5 million.
That's for the whole bill, I think.
That's for the whole bill,
isn't it?
Correct. That's the extension of the biomass and the film, the increase into the film and video.
And can you just, may I ask one more follow-up? Can you break down that $17.5 million for me? How much is the biomass tax credit and how much is the film credit?
It's about half and half. $8 million is the film and video, and then $9.5 million is the biomass.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I just need to say that while I am extremely supportive of the dairy industry in the state, including all CAFO operations, I'm going to be a no on the bill.
Thank you. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was watching the committee laid out in my office, not feeling great today. So it's great to be here in person, finally. I know you all greatly missed me. I want to just say I'm very supportive of the OPIF program. I've been supportive since entering the legislature in the Economic Development Committee. I think growing the film industry in Oregon has been extremely successful, and this has been part of it. The industry is maturing in many ways. I think in each session we've raised this bar or this cap a little bit, every session I've been a part of, maybe excluding a short session or a special session here or there. And I think next session or in the coming sessions it would continue to behoove us to look at the economic research out there, because more and more states have adopted production tax credits of various forms or production subsidies, and I think there's great value to them in moderation. I don't think we're anywhere near where some other states are currently or planning on going and offering hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of incentives. This is a relatively modest program in light of some of those incentives. At the same time, I think it would be great in this committee and in our Economic Development Committee in the coming sessions to, I think, an update to the economic analysis is coming. Be excited to see that. And to compare also where we are vis-a-vis other states, maybe west of the Mississippi or west of the Rockies, in how we compare withdrawing that talent and using this. All that said, I'm very supportive of the program. I think it's working, and I think these modest changes that we've been making every session, including the policy changes in this bill, really do improve the program.
Thank you. Other comments? I would simply adopt Representative Bence's comments. I agree with him completely that we need to continue to review these credits. I think no one should assume that any particular credit is going to be extended past the sunset date. I think it's very important for people not to assume that. When we adopted these rules in 2009, we established a six-year rotating schedule for a review of the income tax credits in Oregon. It was relatively arbitrary, the number of years that we picked and the subjects that we chose to put in each of the three categories. Since then, I've become aware of the reality that some business cycles don't work very well on a six-year cycle, and don't work very well on a six-year cycle when a renewal discussion occurs in the fifth year, which is what our custom has been. I have been trying to understand how that business cycle does work and whether or not it makes sense to change the review for some of these business cycles, some of these different categories, to the third year instead of the fifth year, or to have some of them be sunsetted over a longer period of time, and then review it 3 years out instead of 1 year out. I think that, to be fair to the members of the committee, I have substantial pushback against that possibility, but I think it's worth considering, and it would deal with the fact that we seem to be taking a number of these out of cycle, and I think it's partly because of the experience. The lack of experience we've had with the process, and partly trying to err in the direction of supporting the policies that have been adopted by earlier legislatures, and continuing to pursue the business supports that they thought were important. The federal government has demonstrated very clearly that the very worst thing we can do with incentives that are tax-based is to be inconsistent with them. I mean, everyone in the room knows about their adopting various tax incentives at the end of a year that were supposed to incent behavior during the year. One of those things that makes absolutely no sense unless people assume that they were going to blink and actually do that. We haven't made that particular error, but at the same time, no one should assume that because we've supported a particular industry or approach in the past, that means we're going to do the same thing in the future. I think that's a serious mistake. Our job is to raise revenue. We only give it away grudgingly. I think that's a fair statement. Representative Davis.
I'm sorry, Chair. I had one question about Section 3, which I don't believe was discussed.
Please go ahead.
Just to clarify, this is a section with respect to refund of the kicker and offsetting against existing liability. Chris, can you summarize that section briefly?
Basically, this was an issue that DUR came to you during legislative days.
Yes.
And it has to do with it being a tax credit for the first time. Mm. Since the mid-90s, and overlapping with the ability of taxpayers to donate their kicker to the school fund, to the common school fund. And there could be a situation where if somebody checked off that they wanted to donate their kicker to the common school fund and they got the credit and they still had some outstanding liabilities, and how it was apportioned across those. Basically, the method that DOR would use to apply the kicker to outstanding debt first, and then the remainder to the common school fund, because it was kind of an all or nothing situation to the school fund.
Follow up.
This was the head nod incident that you will probably recall from, I think, September, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
The head nod incident.
Yes.
I'm not ringing bells.
They asked us, we were not in a position to pass anything,
yes,
because we were meeting in interim. And we heard what the problem was, and they asked us, did we think it was okay? And we nodded our heads. This
without power to do anything.
Without power to actually nod. Do anything. This particular piece
not here.
Says that we are now following through with our head nod.
And follow-up. And so just to clarify, the intent and the substance of this is that for those taxpayers with outstanding liability, the liability is paid prior to any donation.
Right, and DOR needed some direction because tax reforms are out in place before you could act. So this codifies
that
action. This says we're going to do what we said we were going to do.
It seems to be good policy. Thank you.
Right. Representative Betts.
Chair, if we may return for a moment to the tax credit discussion that you,
thank you.
And I both have.
Yeah, I probably got ahead of you. Didn't I? Please go ahead.
I just want to say we have had situations where in midstream, maybe we've extended a tax credit out 3, 4 years, perhaps, and maybe 2 years out, it's brought to our attention that it's not working quite the way we anticipated.
Yes.
And people will then come in and say, well, don't jerk the rug out from underneath us. We committed and we did this, we did that. It seems to me that is your consistency argument, but it also seems to me that we would be within the realm of proceeding correctly if we went back and checked to see what assertions were made when we decided to extend the credit. Mm-hmm. And I understand, although we didn't have the hearing here, it was held in the Senate, and the normal points of reference that we look at in extending a tax credit were brought up, evidence was presented. And if it happens 2 years from now that perhaps there's been some straying away from those standards, then we would be within, in my opinion, our legislative discretion to go in and make a change, because that would mean something had changed from what we had based our decision to make a 6-year, 4-year, through whatever it turns out to be upon. And this is terrifically important because things do tend to change over time.
Yep.
And when we use these financing devices, as imprecise as tax credits are, we need to make sure that those who are enjoying the benefits of them don't get too accustomed to saying, well, gee, it's a 6-year credit. They can't touch us. That would not be true. And I want the record to be really, really clear on this. Because at any time, people may be asked to come in, and maybe we're going to true up. Maybe we're going to see if it's working.
Yeah.
And because the state's money too important not to keep checking.
Yeah.
That was my point.
Thank you. And that was a different point than I thought you were making. And I completely agree with this point.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
I'm actually just fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
You should add something to that.
Any other discussion? The motion is on sending the bill to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Please call the roll.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Leiniger.
Aye.
Representative Nose.
Yes.
Representative Whitson.
No.
Vice Chair Betts.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Representative Smith Warner is excused. The chair votes aye. The motion having received the required majority, the motion carries. Bill goes to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and I think I better carry. And with that, we'll close the work session, and committee is adjourned.
Chair. All right.